Assistant Chief Constable Chris Sheed has appealed to Ash's family.
If he doesn't receive urgent medical care or the wrong treatment is given, his condition will become life-threatening.
South Yorkshire's top police officer says his force is looking into whether any of its staff should be disciplined over the Rotherham sex abuse scandal. Chief Constable David Crompton says he's studying a report which revealed 1,400 children were groomed in the town over 16 years. A major donor to UKIP thinks two more Conservatives are seriously considering defecting to the party. If true, they'd follow Clacton MP Douglas Carswell, who switched yesterday. Hospitals in England are going to be ranked on the quality of the food they prepare. If it must meet guidelines on salt, sugar and fat and be sustainably sourced. And the Mercedes Formula One team has taken disciplinary action against Nico Rosberg after he admitted being responsible for a collision which put teammate Lewis Hamilton out of last weekend's Belgian Grand Prix. The Germans also apologised. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
This is BCFM 93.2. The number one choice for Bristol.
Hello out there in Radio Land. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's a Labour member of the Mayor's Cabinet. She's actually also officially entitled Assistant Mayor, and she has responsibility for children and young people and education in the city. She's the Councillor for South Mead, Brenda Massey. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, not another one, South Yorkshire released a report with 1,200 underage young people have been sexually exploited, but the police and social services haven't done anywhere near enough about it. Is Britain now officially the child abuse capital of the world, or are we just the only country with the courage to acknowledge and deal with it? And it's the toughest gang in the world. Well, if we see if they pick a fight with Russia and China, if they're the toughest, well, maybe we won't be alive to watch it. Anyway, the transatlantic protection racket, NATO, descend on Newport for their annual conference this weekend and during next week, bringing with them a 10-mile ring of steel. Coincidentally, not because of NATO turning up, of course, but David Cameron has announced that the UK terror threat level today has moved up a magic notch to severe. So, this is ISIS that they're talking about. Can ISIS really blow us up from Iraq? Or are Muslims just being scapegoated once more in a pattern bearing rather too much similarity to Hitler's scapegoating of the Jews? Also, NATO's secret political lobby group, founded by a former SS officer, the German investigative website Alles Schau und Rausch, which means all smoke and fire, has uncovered the venue in Tyrol, Austria, for the next Bilderberg meeting in June 2015. Plus, the NHS's black list of health workers who may never work again because they have brought up patient safety matters with their bosses. Does the culture of shut your mouth and do what you're told really work in our clinics and hospitals? Or is this just more of the culture of bullying and secrecy that the two merchant venturer bosses of Bristol NHS have ushered in? Plus, it's Martin's thankfully Ebola-free chance to take us around some of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius with some light showers and gusty winds. This weekend, highs of 21, fairly sunny weekend. Highs of 24 degrees Celsius next week, showery on Monday, but warming up and getting sunnier as the week progresses. Next weekend, that's the 6th and 7th of September, highs of 23 and sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's a Labour's member of the Mayor's Cabinet. She's the Assistant Mayor with responsibility for children and young people and education. That's quite a lot. Councillor for South Mead, Brenda Massey. Hi, Brenda. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Thank you for having me.
It's quite a long title, that, isn't it? What exactly, though, does Assistant Mayor mean?
I'm one of the five members of cabinets working with George Ferguson, the mayor. Although actually there's four assistant mayors and a deputy mayor who is Jeff Gollop.
Does he find himself a bit crowded out with all you deputies and assistants all crowding round him to try and help him with all of his decisions?
I think he manages.
But what does it actually really mean? I mean, it just sounds to me like a sort of a title to butter you up a bit.
I don't think that's the situation at all. No, it's actually a lot of work, and I've got a wider responsibility than just children and young people, because I'm now the assistant mayor or cabinet member for people, which covers a huge variety of various parts of the council, including social services and adult social care. All sorts of things in there. Anything you can think of to do with people seems to come my way.
Okay, but surely at the end of the day, George is just making his own decisions. He doesn't really have to listen to you.
The mayor does make his own decisions. You're absolutely right in that. However, we are there as a cabinet to review current issues coming forward and to give him our advice and suggestions on whatever is coming forward.
So are all of the cabinet members deputy mayors?
Assistant mayors.
Sorry,
there's one deputy mayor.
We're getting mixed up here, aren't I?
One deputy mayor, that's Jeff, and four of us who are assistant mayors. And okay. We all have different portfolios.
Oh, right. So you're not actually elbowing each other to try and get George's attention then?
No.
The responsibility for children and young people, though, is a massive one. What does that actually mean practically day to day?
It is actually a huge one, and that's what I was originally working on until this May, when my portfolio expanded with reorganisation within the council. It covers lots of things, starting with...
Sorry to stop you, Brenda, but how can it expand from children, young people and education? Surely you've got enough on your plate with that lot.
I thought that as well. But it was because the whole council structure was reorganised into different directorates, and the portfolio went with it. Also, you probably know that Councillor Jank has left the cabinet. She's going to be Lady Jank of Clifton, I believe, in the not too distant future. So she is no longer a cabinet member, and I've picked up what she was looking at, most of her.
So what's Barbara going to do? I was always a little bit bemused by Barbara, because I remember when the Lib Dems were in opposition in the city, it was Steve Comer was the leader of the Lib Dem party. But then once they got into power, he was kind of elbowed out. And I find that a little bit almost embarrassing, really, that the person that's got you in, at least led the party into power, is then told, well, I'll be sorry, we don't need your services anymore. Barbara's taking over.
Well, I can't really comment on the internal processes of the Lib Dems in how they appoint their leader or make any changes in there.
OK, so how were you appointed to the cabinet by the Labour group then?
Very democratically. We put our names forward for taking on lead roles, and we are voted on by our fellow Labour councillors. And following that, then the decision is made as to which person's name will go forward.
So, but doesn't George get a say?
Absolutely. It's up to him to agree or not the nominations going forward.
Okay, so various people are suggested to George. He says, yeah, I want this one, and then everyone votes. And what happens if the Labour Party vote for somebody that George doesn't want?
We haven't got to that stage yet, but who knows in the future.
Well, this sounds a little bit like the parties are really bowing to George's power, because George is saying, well, there's only certain people that I want to be in the cabinet. And so rather than have a fight with George, they're saying, well, we'll put forward for cabinet people that you want, George.
I don't think that was quite the situation. I would like to think that the people whose names were put forward for specific roles were those people who had the most knowledge of those particular areas. For instance, with Mark Bradshaw and transport, that is something he's been very heavily involved in for a considerable number of years. So it wasn't a case of George only accepting certain people.
Okay, tell us a bit about yourself, Brenda. What brought you into politics?
Well, I'd been a school governor for many, many years.
Where?
In a whole variety of schools, different ones, not just in one school.
Well, are you talking about in Bristol?
In Bristol.
Yeah.
I was born in Bristol.
Okay, give us an idea of whereabouts you were doing that.
I have been a school governor at Fonthill Infants. For a short time, I was a governor at Monk's Park. I'm currently a governor at Filton Avenue Juniors and Baydocks Wood Primary. I've also been a governor in the past at Horfield C of E School.
Well, it's brilliant to have you here because you've seen all the changes that have been brought in by Michael Gove and the Conservatives into the education yes. system. Tell us about those. Where do we start?
I was going to say, I think that is such a long list that it would probably take your entire hour to go through those.
If you could just cherry pick a couple of things that you've seen go through that maybe you know you weren't happy with or something you actually thought was good even maybe.
I think the most recent one that's caused a lot of consternation has been the move with exams going from children being assessed on coursework to having to sit one exam. When I was at school, everything depended on one final exam. And the change to actually viewing a child's progress over a year or more and looking at what they could do during that period of time, to me seems a lot fairer. Because everybody can have a bad day. Somebody may not be feeling well on exam day. There's all sorts of things. So much depends on that one day. And I think looking at their continuing coursework gives you a much fairer view of what they're capable of.
But surely, I mean, coursework is something that you could, I mean, if you wanted to, you could spend weeks on doing one piece of coursework, whereas another pupil might only spend a couple of days on it. So it all depends on the amount of time you're devoting to it as to whether you pass or not. So it's not really a good way of necessarily assessing an individual child's ability.
I don't think anybody would be working in that way, because the teachers will be reviewing what they're doing all the time, and they wouldn't have endless time to just focus on one thing. There is a syllabus to go through.
Anything else that you'd like to point to about changes that you've seen through the education? Because obviously we all care deeply about our young people, and a lot of people have been tearing their hair out about the way that, particularly resources are being snatched away from schools. I was listening on the radio during the week, absolutely appalling, on 5 Live to hear that that some classes are 50 pupils to a teacher, and the school's not having the space even to do the teaching.
Well, we haven't got any classes like that in Bristol, I can assure you. Actually, the mayor is very supportive of education, which is really good, and we have been working very hard. I feel personally that education in Bristol is improving, and the fact that we are working together with the not just maintained schools that are under our control, but academies, private schools, independent schools, we are actually in a much better place now than we have been previously.
I mean, we're in a situation, aren't we, where, for example, Colston Girls School is now getting state funding. I mean, it's a private school. Why should it get state funding?
Well, that's again is something I can't really comment on with how the funding is arranged, but I would say that we have got very good relationships with the majority of our schools in Bristol. They are very keen. What I have been trying to encourage over the last year has been everybody working together, and no one school has got the perfect answer, but working together we can all improve things, and at the end of the day we all want the best for our children.
I was chatting to a friend of mine the other day who's a young lad is at Bedminster Down School, not having a fantastic time there, and what's happening is in other schools around the city are sort of cherry-picking kids. They're writing to the parents saying, why don't you send your kid here? Why don't you send your children here to be educated? It's so much better. It's much better funded. A lot of them are backed by industry, by corporations. It's the privatisation of teaching, and it's almost like a marketplace now.
There is a degree of that. I'm sure you will have seen banners on various places around the city saying this school has got very good results and so on.
Good, and targeted personal letters coming through the letterbox to parents.
Right. Well, I haven't seen any of those, so it would be difficult to comment. But I mean, obviously, you know, we have... You shouldn't forget that we've got one of the largest rises in the birth rate in Bristol of any city at the moment, a 30% increase. So we have an awful lot of children and young people in the city. And one of my main aims is to make sure we've got appropriate education for all of them, including school buildings. But I would say that the very recent things that have happened have been looking at our GCSE results and our A levels, that they are going up considerably, and you know the levels they're achieving are great improvement. We've gone up 10% in the last 10 years.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We're talking about education, got to bring you in, because there is a sea change. There has been a sea change in education, and we've got the Cabinet's education expert here. So what are your thoughts about the way things have changed with free schools and academies? Because it's now no longer a state education system. There are all sorts of different arms to it. Some of them are corporate. Some of them are very corporate, where big companies are actually putting massive amounts of money into a particular school because they want to suck in all the best pupils there.
Well, I'm afraid that successive reforms in a more marketised direction are very difficult to reverse, even if you wanted to reverse them. So it's the whole problem. If you start off with an aquarium, which is, you know, the old local education authority system, you turn it into fish soup, which is a great big mess, and it's very difficult to get it any kind of overall structure and plan back into it, although I accept that what Brenda is trying to do is bring some kind of overall pattern to it. Because, of course, what's actually happening is that it's not even very efficient. People setting up schools outside of the maintained system and then getting funding for them, and then you end up with some schools are bursting with pupils, and other schools have got unused facilities. So it's not actually a very efficient way to do things. I mean, that's why the local education authorities were set up in the first place, to ensure the efficient.
I mean, just for example,
resources.
If HSBC decide they want to set up a school, they're going to have all the best pupils in the city, aren't they?
Not necessarily, but what does happen is if you've got competition between schools. My father was a head teacher in the 1980s when these kind of reforms were pioneered, and what he was saying is that each school should have a fixed budget, so that if you're going to have choice, supposedly, then you can go to the popular school with 30 in the class or the unpopular school with 15. But of course the real problem is that the money follows the pupils, and therefore of course you then get schools which are oversubscribed, which people can't get into, so they don't get their choice anyway because they can't get in, and then other schools that nobody wants to go to, apart from kids who are demoralised and parents who don't care too much and teachers who are and of course it's very difficult to break when you've got league tables and so on. Somebody has to win, but by the same token somebody else has to lose. And that the principle should surely be that every school should be of a standard that is acceptable, and nobody should be obliged to tolerate being forced into a sink school. But of course, that is what happens.
I would argue with your definition of a sink school, Martin, because I don't think we've got any sink schools in Bristol. Most of our schools are performing very well, and we're on the up here. So I understand what you mean about some schools being oversubscribed. I think sometimes parents are not particularly realistic about which schools they opt for, and go for one that's got a name, as it were, rather than looking at their local one, which could provide an excellent education for their children and have very caring and understanding teachers who are operating at a very high level.
I mean, you say we don't have any sink schools, but I bet you parents won't say that. I bet some of them will say, actually, yes, we're trying to get our children out of one school into a better school, and we're finding it very difficult.
Well, I think you have to look at our results and our Ofsted inspections. We've got children in Bristol are going to very high standards now. I don't think we've got any left now at all that are in special measures. They are all on the improving scale.
Anyway, let's talk about another biggie which is floating around the cabinet at the moment, which is the Bristol Arena. Now, I did ask you if you could swat up a bit on this, Brenda, because I want to know, is the arena going to happen, and is the City Council going to be left to fill a funding shortfall at the moment? I mean, this is something that's been talked about for at least 10 years in the city. Seems to me a little bit like a kind of vanity project that should be done by some kind of commercial organisation, not necessarily by the city, when we've got, 15,000 people waiting homeless with nowhere to live, that we do something like this. I think the basic idea, if I'm right, is that if you create this arena, then it's going to create a kind of magnet for business, and it's going to actually multiply jobs. So you'll have the jobs created by the arena, and then magically all around it are going to spring up lots of other businesses. I don't know if it's going to be like a burger stands or what, but around the arena to attract them into the area.
I mean the idea behind having an arena is that actually Bristol is a big city and is the only one of the eight core cities that hasn't got an arena at present. The largest space we've got will only hold 2,000 people.
But if we wanted to do a concert, can't we use one of the football stadiums, for example?
Well, Having a designated space that is not just used for concerts but for all sorts of things is probably quite an advantage. We're anticipating the arena will probably hold 12,000. That'll be the capacity there. It will raise Bristol's profile, and it should attract money into the city in the form of investment and businesses. If you think about it now, Bristol has got hotels but no venue, so quite often you get some event going on in Cardiff and
The NATO conference, for example.
I couldn't possibly comment. Yes.
So is Obama going to be staying in a Bristol hotel?
Well, I don't know. Nobody's told me.
An empty hotel. It's cheap.
Possibly. I'm not part of his inner circle, so I don't know. But it is something that will actually hopefully be a huge boost to the local economy. And it's also important to remember that it will be... We are very committed as a council to apprenticeships, and hopefully a lot of young people will get jobs as a result of this.
It's costing £91 million, apparently, altogether.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about how much the council are paying towards it. I think it's about 19 million, isn't it? Something like that, 20 million. It seems like a lot of money for something which actually is not necessarily going to bring any kind of return to the city, and it's not going to deliver for a lot of people that have very little, low income or negative income, as so many people do nowadays, finding it difficult to pay the rent and the bills. Are they going to be able to enjoy this new event, arena?
Well, the funding for the arena is a lot of it will come from the operator, who will be paying for the lease and the commercial entity there. So it won't all be funded by the City Council. It'll be a variety of funding streams that pay for this.
The other thing, of course, is that it might be that we're obviously going to be borrowing money to do it, and then we may have to be paying the debts back for years to come. It might be, really difficult thing to pay off in the future. You know, basically a burden on us, Martin.
Well, I think that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? If you're going to invest this sort of money, is it going to be a wise investment? And to be honest, I haven't looked at the figures to assess whether it is or it isn't. I mean, that's what we employ both council staff and elected politicians to look into properly. I fear that there is going to be a further crash. And if there is a further crash, I think big projects like this will become unviable.
Well, if the funding from the government's not forthcoming, we have trouble putting this together. Enough money, Brenda.
Money has been secured, apparently.
Escalate. Bristol Council taxpayers might be left with a debt for decades to come. And I'm just looking at something in Sheffield, in the World Student Games in the early 1990s. It was a crippling debt that has crippled Sheffield for many years later. So we've secured funding for it. Why isn't it already being built then?
Because it's still going through the process. They're partway through the process of appointing an operator, and as I said, that operator will be paying for the lease. So there's $4 million coming from that. There's another $34 million coming from rental or different rentals and income for BCC. There's been a lot of... They're now coming up to the design phase, and there will be a competition for this. What I think is interesting is that there will be a lot of public engagement and ability for the public to comment on what they think is the best design. So that's quite an interesting idea there.
Well,
so there will be public consultation in January next year about this.
And the
contract for the design should be awarded round about February 2015.
Well, according to the Lib Dems, there's a shortfall of £53 million, and the figures just simply don't stack up for the arena. Just an email I got last week here. The City Council's currently looking for this to be supported by the City deal. Without that support, the arena scheme's probably not viable. The Council's business rate growth projections show it could take 10 years or more to build up enough money for the Council to pay back the borrowing for the arena at that level. The only other way the Council could make up the shortfall would be to savagely cut back on everything else the in the council's capital programme. There's a suspicion that this is why there's been no movement on the East Bristol Pool or the South Bristol Recycling Centre. So other things are suffering. This is what the Lib Dems are alleging anyway, Brenda, because everything is being focused on the arena, which is basically, like I say, a vanity project. Other things, you know, like a pool, which is necessary, it's not a vanity project, and a recycling centre, things like that, are suffering because of this.
Well, obviously, the arena is not in my portfolio, so I haven't got an in-depth knowledge of it. So it's quite difficult to comment on some of these things. But it is intended it will be open round about the end of 2017. And as I said, there will be a lot of consultation going forward.
Maybe we should try and get the project manager for it in here to have a chat with us.
Probably be a very good idea.
To explain it all.
Yes. Anyway,
news this week that the Badger Coal is going to restart in Gloucestershire and Somerset. I thought the Badger Coal had gone away. One of the reasons I brought this up is because we sat down on this show, actually live on the programme, and calculated something like £31,000 had been spent by the public per badger killed so far. That's £27,000 per badger for the DEFRA report that justified it in the first place, which cost £50 million. And plus each badger actually on the cull itself cost £4,000 in wages and fees to kill. So these badgers are getting pretty expensive. Anyway, Martin, I just wonder if you want to comment on this. Why are we killing badgers, especially if they're costing £31,000 to each to kill?
Well, the whole economics of agricultural production is a massive maze of conflicting interests. It's nothing to do with the free market. If we were going to have a free market, we'd probably buy our dairy products from New Zealand, because that's how the free market would work.
Well, we had Derek Mead on here, who's the National Farmers Union rep for Somerset, and he was saying, actually, the whole thing's a farce. He's a dairy farmer. Mm. And he was saying, you know, you can vaccinate a few. And also, that the tests they use to decide if cows got TB, 9 times out of 10, they say, yes, it has, when it hasn't. So anyway, I wonder if you've got any thoughts on this, Barbara. Brenda, sorry.
Do you know, I can't imagine the number of people who call me Barbara. I don't know why, but
it must
anyway.
Be their hair.
We don't look the same. However, I am absolutely against the Badger Coal. I think it's a completely the wrong thing to do. I really think there should be more emphasis on vaccination and inoculating cows against it. It hasn't, it's obviously not been successful. It was lamentable, the results from the first attempt to do it, and I just think it's completely the wrong thing to do. So I'm absolutely totally against it.
One of the other things, of course, is once the badgers get wind of badgers being killed in the area, they scarper. You know, then if they have got TB, they're spreading it around. Mm. Whole thing seems completely bonkers to me. Martin, any real explanation for this? Any thoughts of why what might be a hidden agenda or something?
What's going on is that there are vested interests involved all the way. So, for example, Russia has just put a ban on Western produced food going into Russia. Now, that will have a knock-on effect on Somerset farmers, because even if they don't export to Russia, there are other places where they're exporting to, they will be, and there's a glut now developing of dairy products in Western Europe as a result of this export ban. Now, in other words, there's no free market in any of this. As I said earlier, when New Zealand was able to send frozen lamb to London cheaper than it could be brought from Wales in 1888, if you were going to have a free market, you wouldn't have any agriculture, or hardly any at all, in Britain. Now, I'm not in favour of that. I'm all in favour of having some agriculture, but let's not pretend it's a free market. So we are basically protecting farmers to have cattle, so we're giving them a subsidy, and then when that goes wrong, we are then spending more money to protect the farmers, to carry on being subsidised, to carry on doing something.
But it's only some farmers that say that they need protecting. Well, most indeed. Of them are saying that the whole thing about TB has been blown way out of proportion.
Well, the point I'd make is what most people want from the countryside is things like badgers and not necessarily a butter mountain.
Okay. The royal family has been granted a new right of secrecy. So rather than having to spend millions of pounds on lawyers to keep all of their private conversations, supposed private conversations with government top government ministers, civil servants, etc., secret. It looks like they're going to have that change the law, so they don't have to spend any more money on lawyers. This is the Home Affairs editor of the Independent, Robert Verkaik, in the Independent. The royal family is to be granted absolute protection from public scrutiny in a controversial legal reform designed to draw a veil of secrecy over the affairs of the Queen, Prince Charles and Prince William. Lobbying and correspondence from junior staff working for the royal household and Prince Charles will now be held back from disclosure. Buckingham Palace confirmed it consulted with the coalition government over the change in the law. Government's buried the plan for added protection for the royal family in a small print of plans called Opening Up Public Bodies to Public Scrutiny. So rather than opening up public bodies, they seem to be closing them down. Brenda, what are your thoughts about the royals? Do they really, are they part of the government? And so should they be under freedom of information, or are they a sort of rather wealthy private family?
Well, they're a good tourist attraction. I assume that this is in...
Do you ever actually get to see the royals if you go to Buckingham Palace? I mean, I'm not sure.
I've not been to Buckingham Palace, so I don't know.
Well, people come to Britain just in the thought that, wow, I'm standing in the same country as the Queen. Because most of the tourists aren't ever going to get to see the royal family. But anyway, sorry, back to the substantive point about, is it a private family or is it part of the government?
Well, most of it is private, isn't it? And I'm assuming that this this reaction, which I didn't know about until today, is a response to the famous Black Spider letters from Prince Charles to government ministers and so on. I do think it's a bit odd.
But they're not the normal kind of private family, though, are they? Because, say, for example, you die without leaving a will, they get your money, they get your estate. I mean, you know, Martin's a private individual. He doesn't get your estate if you die without leaving a will. Martin, what's your thoughts about the influence of the royals today?
Well, I mean, you've put your finger on it. It's the question is, what is their public role and what is their private role? Now, they're very, very wealthy. They're some of the wealthiest people in the world as private individuals, and they also receive a fairly substantial amounts from the taxpayer to do their public duties. Now, if you were going to have a cut price monarchy, the sort of thing they have in Scandinavia, then ultimately they just become servants of the government. Because don't forget that the Duchy of Cornwall, for example, which belongs personally to the Prince of Wales, you could argue that that actually belongs to the British people and has been given to him to look after. That's, you know,
well, there's a lot of people in Cornwall who would agree with you.
Well,
yeah.
Exactly. When William III was brought in by Parliament to be the king, the deal was that we will decide what you can and can't do. And ultimately, this has got to be rationalised for everybody's benefit, including theirs.
I'm thinking
so
also...
So everybody knows what the deal is.
I'm
and
thinking
what exactly
also
is the public
about
aspect of what they do and what
the
is
the right to veto, which was revealed as well, where rather than them, Prince Charles and the Queen, just literally signing... laws with the royal prerogative, they can say, actually, no, we're not going to sign this one, we'd like a few changes to it, please. And they do that quite regularly in secret. Brenda.
Yes, I mean, Martin is absolutely right about the amount of money they've got, and asking for more public money at different times is... you do think that really they should be spending their own money on some of these places that they're able to live in. Vast palaces that most of us have no chance of getting to, but it is a very difficult position.
But those palaces are very, very difficult to upkeep. I'm afraid they need a little bit more money all the time to keep all the palaces up to scratch.
Well, perhaps they could give them to the National Trust and we could all go and have holiday lets in them.
Or perhaps they should be bedroom taxed and be forced to use them for social housing. Yeah. Anyway,
that would be interesting.
Talking of the cost of housing, 3 million parents cut back on food to pay the rent. This is a really nasty one this week. In the International Business Times, northern cities in England dominate the top 10 locations for affordability. The cost of housing is a major issue for people living in England, as 3 million working parents have cut back on buying food in a bid to help pay their rent or mortgage, according to a homeless charity Shelter. A poll which was conducted by YouGov and questioned more than 10,000 respondents in July this year found that 36.7%, that's around about a third, isn't it, of working adults with children aged under 18 said they'd cut back on the amount they spend on food. to help pay for their housing costs, equivalent to 3.1 million parents. Research also revealed more than 1 in 10 parents, that's 10%, equivalent to over 750,000 people, had gone to the extreme of skipping meals to help pay for their home. Now, Brenda, what do you make of this? It's another one of those stories that I always link this pretty much straight back to the 2008 bailout. The government is spending less and less on supporting people, and the economy seems to be conking out because all of the money seems to be going now to repay loans that we used to bail the banks out.
Yes, I know, and I think the most worrying thing is the rise, huge rise, in food banks around the country. And we shouldn't be, we are a European nation, we should not be in the position where anybody has to go to a food bank just to survive. And that's what I find really absolutely awful.
So what would you do about it if you had the ear of the, or if you could twist the arm a little bit gently of George Osborne?
That would be interesting. Yes. One of the other issues, of course, is the fact that we don't actually have enough housing for a lot of people. So they are living in rented accommodation with high rents there too. And as it says, they're cutting back just to pay the rent to keep their children housed. That's just awful. We shouldn't be in this situation in a society nowadays.
The findings come after research from the estate agent Knight Frank found that northern cities in England dominate the top 10 locations for affordability because house prices are far smaller multiple of average earnings than elsewhere. So we've got a big divide, haven't we, between north and south as well, Martin? It's very difficult to afford.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's always been this fundamental imbalance in the British economy between north and south of the Wash, the M4 corridor and the rest. And, of course, the housing benefit bill is massively increasing, despite the government's huffing and puffing, because more and more people are being forced into private rented accommodation. Many of the private rented accommodations were originally council houses, sold to their owners, and then sold on to other owners who are now using them as buy-to-let. And then the government ends up picking the bill for the rent, which is up to three times more than a social housing rent, and breaking the bank of the government.
Well, I was looking
and
at a tweet
because we haven't got enough affordable housing for low-income people.
Looking at a tweet from the Fire Brigade Union yesterday, and the government borrowing, the deficit is rising. They say April to May 2013 is 22.1 billion, April to May 2014 is 24.8 billion. So the actual amount that we're needing to borrow month on month is going up, not down. I thought we were supposed to be dealing with this.
Well, the fact is that George Osborne, about a year, 18 months ago, saw the election coming over the horizon and said, actually, we're not going to be able to reduce the deficit in one parliament, as we've been saying from the very beginning. And, of course, the economy was flatlining for ages, so they weren't doing much good from that point of view. And they've suddenly decided that they can let the deficit increase, and not increase, but rather not go down over two parliaments, because they want to win the election. And, of course, that's what Ed Balls was saying from the beginning.
Okay.
You can't reduce it all in one go.
We'll stop moaning about this, because it's quite clearly a train crash waiting to happen. What we're interested in here on this show is some solutions. And there was a great tweet from Michael Meacher, MP. Actually, it was an article, Stop Austerity and Cut the Deficit by Printing Money and Sending a Cheque to Every Household Except the Richest Top Quarter. This is Michael Meacher's solution. He says, Armand Montebourg, France's economy minister, who's just resigned, is quite right. He denounced austerity policies as absurd because they brought about the most destructive crisis in Europe since 1929. He rightly attacked the Eurozone's fiscal stance as the cause of the unnecessary prolongation of the economic crisis and the suffering of the European population. He correctly demanded a major change of policy away from the extreme orthodoxy of the German right. Montebourg is not the only one who's been railing against the absurdity of counterproductive policies which are relentlessly dragging down the Eurozone into deflation. Renzi, the young Italian Prime Minister, has rightly been demanding an easing of overtight fiscal policies, a longer timescale to generate the growth and enable his country to overcome its excessive debtedness. So when is the penny going to drop here in Britain, Martin, that actually what we've got to do is if we're going to be printing money, that money can't be going into the stock exchange and asset prices to the savings of the rich, keeping them going up. It's got to be spent on the poorest quarter, or the poorest three quarters, Meacher is suggesting here, of society, who will then spend it and get things moving.
Well, I mean, you need a change of government for that. As I just pointed out, George Osborne has decided that we're going to reduce the deficit over two parliaments rather than one, although he didn't trumpet it from the rooftop.
Well, it's like a cartoon. Every time it comes along to an election, they're saying we're going to do it the next time, and then when it comes to the next election, they're saying exactly the same again. Well, they're shifting the goalposts, and it's receding into the over the horizon the whole time, this decision.
Well, it is, and also, of course, what they're doing by having quantitative easing and so on is actually protecting the assets of the wealthy. Now, of course, you can, with the currency, we've got a separate currency from the Eurozone, and we've decided to ease up on the deficit reduction, and we've pumped up the stock market through housing prices. And, of course, that is actually just creating a bubble which will burst. Now, the question is, will the bubble burst before next May, the next election, or will it burst afterwards? But ultimately, of course, we need to redistribute income in favour of the people at the bottom of the pile.
But we mentioned,
at the moment, we're redistributing it the opposite direction. It's Robin Hood in reverse, isn't it? But it's got nothing to do with the free market. It's a political decision.
We mentioned George Osborne a minute ago, Brenda. He's been accused of lying to Parliament on his hard line against corporate tax avoidance. So he says he's doing something about tax avoidance, but he's also being accused of lying about it. The Chancellor told MPs in March that HM Revenue and Customs was collecting twice as much tax as before through new measures to target the super rich and multinationals who employ expensive accountants and lawyers in order to shelter their vast wealth in overseas tax havens. However, inquiries by the Independent and Private Eye established that Mr. Osborne was not referring to physical money already banked by the state and was only outlining a target of tax collected for this Parliament. So he's been fibbing, hasn't he?
Yes. In a word, I'm afraid that's absolutely true.
So, I mean, what can be done about this tax avoidance? Because it's all apparently perfectly legal. You just shift your money around, and when the tax man goes to grab it, he finds there's nothing there. It's gone to Jersey.
Yep, and that is really so unfair, because the majority of us, we pay our taxes, we don't employ accountants, we just do what we're supposed to do and pay according to
It's unfair, but it's not illegal.
It's not, and that's the worst of it. And these companies and these rich people are finding every possible loophole they can to get out of paying. And you know, we need the tax money to pay for to support the infrastructure.
Martin, I must say, I mean, it sounds a little bit like gangsterism, this. It's like, they're our mates, so we're going to pretend to tax them, but you're not, so even though you haven't got any money, we're going to tax you.
Yeah, well, of course, it's ultimately self-defeating, because you actually need rising wages of the majority to make the economy
But aren't they just
properly.
Thinking, well, we don't really care about anybody else, just our mates?
No, I think effectively the help-to-buy scheme and all the rest of it, and quantitative easing, has been essentially a massive handout for the wealthy.
But it's also getting people into debt that they can't necessarily afford to pay back. This is the subprime thing that created the crash in 2008, the crisis in 2008.
The derivatives market now is bigger than it was in 2008, and ultimately this will crash. I mean, we've got a classic property bubble which is designed for the Tory party.
It's going to go
marginal
pop.
Seats
it's going to go pop
around London
at some point, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, but it's nothing to do with the free market. It's actually free money for those who have, and a kick in the face for those who haven't.
Free money for the rich, how about that? Okay, well, 1,400 Rotherham children were sexually exploited over a 16-year period. I wouldn't necessarily call the older teenagers children, but anyway, that's the headline. The report claims police and council agencies failed victims, some of whom were threatened with guns and gang raped. Rotherham abuse report details and reaction, there was live coverage of that. This is in The Guardian. 1,400 children sexually exploited in Rotherham over a 16-year period, according to a report that concluded it's hard to describe the appalling nature of the abuse that children and victims suffered. Now, this is your portfolio here in the city. Can you guarantee that this kind of thing is not happening in Bristol?
I don't think anybody could guarantee it, but I would certainly hope it does not. This report I've been reading over the last few days, and it's been the most depressing report that I think I have ever read.
What, depressing? It's, what, because of inaction of people who were supposed to be responsible?
Yeah, and ignoring all the warning signs were there, that junior officers in the council were telling senior officers that this this was going on and that they were ignoring it, that the police were ignoring it as well.
There is actually a quite serious criminal offence on there, two criminal offences of misfeasance and malfeasance that the police, without a drop of a hat, could go and arrest these people for. I mean, one is you have to prove that someone's deliberately ignored something, and that's malfeasance, I think. And misfeasance is if they've just neglected their duties and someone has suffered as a result. Basically, it's like the idea of the duty of care, but to somebody in public office. Then there's also misconduct in public office. So there's plenty of things that these people could have had their collars felt over.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Anyway, let's just have a listen now to a man called Martin Kimber. He's the chief executive of Rotherham Council. I mean, obviously, who's our chief executive here, Brenda?
Our chief exec, Nicola.
Nicola. Well, Nicola in Bristol, this is her equivalent up in Rotherham, Martin Kimber, and here he is explaining, if you can call it that, what's been going on up there as a reaction to the report.
Well, I think the report today makes it clear that I'm part of the solution and not part of the problem. It indicates that during the period of my tenure, we've made many improvements to council services and indeed that we continue to improve. One of the things the independent inquiry allows me to do is to reassure members of the public in Rotherham that our services today are safe, that young people that need support today will get the support that they deserve. Well, one of the issues that I've done as a chief executive is to look at the report that Miss Jay's prepared very carefully indeed. As a consequence, I've made a series of recommendations that will go to the council's cabinet next Wednesday, the 3rd of September. It indicates how I propose to deal with issues relating to disciplinary and capability, where there were people working in Rotherham who are still within professional practice. By publishing the report today as we've done, and by publishing my response, I've enabled their current employers to be able to read the report and to form a view as to their particular role within the events that are described within the report. One of the things that I have done is to consider whether there's anything within the report that would require me or enable me to make any referral to a professional body practice referral. And there's nothing specific within the report about any single individual that would enable me to do that.
Yeah, so that was the local chief executive up in Rotherham by the name of Martin Kimber, talking about Professor Alexis Jay's report. But the thing that struck me about that, Brenda, and I'll come to you in a minute, Martin, was first of all saying, well, actually, just simply publishing in the names is really enough, and it will mean that people can have a look and see who they are and make their own judgments, and also he's had a look through all this and he doesn't think that there's any action necessary.
Well, this has been going on for 16 years and the sheer scale of it, and if you read the report, the horrible, absolutely horrific incidents that are contained in there. Some of the children actually tried to report it and they were threatened by members of the gangs, I suppose you could call them, who were conducting this, and they were physically intimidating them. Nobody seemed to be taking any notice. It's all right to say now, well, we've got a report and we'll move forward, but why wasn't somebody doing something during that period of time? It's just appalling. It's been the worst thing I've ever read, this. I have, however, gone through it in fine detail, and I've got a long list of questions which I'm working through with my strategic director for people, which includes this, and we are going through it all at the moment. So, yes, it's not a nice state of affairs.
Well, I mean, I think that this sort of thing has been going on for a very long time, and there's actually an unwillingness to commit resources to dealing with these problems until something like this comes along and forces everybody to confront it. Something like, I'm not quite sure about this, Brenda, you may know, but something like 200 young people are murdered by their carers in Britain every year.
Yes.
Something like that, and that's when you end up with a dead body.
That's right.
Now, that's been going on for years and years and years, and actually, there's not really much of a priority given to this. And you feel like saying to some people sometimes, we need social services departments to be staffed with people who are motivated, well paid, enough staff to deal with the job, the things that they're doing, and that is going to cost money. And unfortunately, it's not one of the things that people make a priority of. When something like this comes along, everybody tears their hair out and goes, why hasn't anything been done about this? But for years and years and years, I mean, social workers in Rotherham have been saying we were actually flagging this stuff up. We were told, let's just play it down because we haven't got the resources to deal with it.
Absolutely.
It's just too big for us to take it on. Now, ultimately, society has got to make its mind up collectively that this stuff is intolerable and that we're going to take whatever steps are necessary to deal with it. And that possibly means that some people are going to have to pay some more taxes.
I mean, surely, it's actually very simple. If someone's got some evidence, then somebody should be arrested. Then they should go to trial and that evidence tested. It's a very, very simple system, it seems to me.
Well, during this period, there were two operations. There was Operation Central, which was between 2008 and 2010, and there were only five convictions came out of that. Operation Tsar, which followed it in 2009, they served abduction notices, but they came up with absolutely no convictions at all. And yet all this was going on during that period of time.
It's actually quite difficult to get convictions because of the nature of the offences. Now, that means that you've got to chuck even more resources at it if you intend to get the convictions. It's a question of what we value. I mean, basically, I'd say to people, if you take two holidays in a year, you should cancel your second holiday and put that money into social services if you want these children to be protected. But people are only interested in this as a whipping boy when their political opponents are shown to have made a mess of it or whatever.
But what about
as a society, we've got to start taking children's rights a lot more seriously
than we do. The Asian angle? Because this is being set, one of the excuses, I mean, it seems to me an excuse anyway, is saying, well, look, because these people are Asian, we didn't feel able to deal with it. What do you think? Do you believe that, Brenda? Martin? And you've read the report, Brenda.
I have read it, and I think I mean that is an issue in there, but actually, does it matter the ethnicity of whoever's the perpetrator? They are doing something which is so wrong, and Martin's right about the social workers. If you read the report, there was a high degree of vacancies there were agency staff involved, there obviously was no particularly strong structure in there, and it's just appalling.
Okay, having read the report, now this is a difficult question, but if you were in Rotherham, you were in the position that you are in here in Bristol up there, who would be being fired and, you know, what would you be up to? Because it seems that you cannot allow people to even continue in their jobs if they've allowed this kind of culture to develop underneath them. I'm thinking particularly about senior managers in the local authority.
Yes, absolutely. They would have to bear responsibility for it. If I was there and I'd been covering this period of time, I would have resigned.
I noticed that the deputy police commissioner resigned, even though the police commissioner hasn't resigned.
Yes,
he's resigned from the Labour Party because the Labour Party were putting under pressure to resign, but he's staying on as police commissioner.
That's right.
Unbelievable.
And he was actually in charge during some of this time.
Yeah.
And there's a fascinating article in The Independent yesterday, Democracy and the Police, a System in Crisis, which is questioning this whole thing of police and crime commissioners. If somebody is in one of these roles, the finger is being pointed at them as being complicit in these crimes up in Rotherham, as to whether it's appropriate for them to manage to continue in their roles. Anyway, following on from our story last week, before we go off, we were following on from the story last week about the privatisation up at Filton. Mark Lefley's been writing again in The Independent about this Abbey Wood privatisation, which is being coming along without, it seems, anybody locally knowing about it. I'm not sure if Jack Lopresti, the local MP, was told, but he certainly wasn't talking to us last week, and we couldn't get hold of him for a comment or anything about Abbey Wood's privatisation. Nearly 19,000 people work for defence equipment and support. What Mark's saying, Martin, is that the press team has clearly been told to keep quiet about Bechtel and CH2M Hill, these two big American companies, winning managed service provider roles, including nothing about a banal formal comment saying that any deals won't be signed and sealed for another month. Keeping stum, though, is a rather futile exercise, given that the department leaks like a sieve. Well, at least it's leaking to Mark Lefley. It's not leaking to us. What are your thoughts about these two companies taking over the Army, the Joint Services, Navy and RAF procurement?
Well, as we said last week, it's very odd that nobody's discussed any of this. The government have just pushed it through on a Bad News Friday before before August bank holiday.
Is it the sort of thing that they might be people at the NATO conference have an interest in any of this?
Well, the people at the NATO conference are the political echelon, so they're not necessarily the arms manufacturers. But of course, there's a lot of the arms manufacturers have their influence.
They go they go round and round. They have this revolving door syndrome, I'm afraid, where some of the politicians just go out of politics and straight into one of these big arms firms onto the board.
Well, the US military industrial complex is way out of control, and of course Britain is totally integrated into that military industrial complex, and I can't see how the government intends to the idea of saving money by putting foxes in charge of the hen house, which is what effectively this is. I don't see that that's going to even achieve its own objectives of saving money.
Brenda, can I just get your comment on Abbey Wood? Because it's a massively important part of our defence infrastructure in Britain. I don't think there's this many people at the entire site up in Abbey Wood, but altogether 19,000, 20,000 people working for defence equipment and support, and it looks like they're going to bring in 120 managers from the United States, from these two big private defence companies, to take over.
Yes, Abbey Wood is actually not too far from where I live, and I know it's been downsizing considerably over the years because I do know some of the people working there. But the fact is that why are we bringing in managers from other countries when we have people here ourselves
who could have a job? For example, Martin, that we might one day be at war with the United States?
Well, we certainly burnt down. It's actually the anniversary of us burning down the White House the other day. Britain burned down the White House in 1812, and apparently there was a jokey tweet from the British Embassy which caused some offence in the US. But I certainly don't think that we should be integrating our public sector decision making capacity to the American private sector. That doesn't seem to... I mean, that seems to me absolutely perverse, especially if you're thinking of saving money. I mean, it's not just about saving money, is it? It's also about British jobs, industrial policy, etc. Will Bechtel care about a future Labour government's industrial policy when it's deciding who should get contracts to build British military equipment? Probably not.
Finally, a bit of a jokey one. We have done a couple of these now, in the traditional news style. That is Bristol Workman actually managing to misspell the word bus. This was in several papers, including the Huffington Post. Bristol made it into the Nationals this week, actually with Banksy too, to be fair. At least if it's a bup should ever come along, it'll know where it needs to stop. Workmen managed to misspell the word bus during roadworks. Bup stop was painted on the road surface in Bristol's Old Market in large yellow lettering at the end of last week, with the stencilled letter P used instead of an S. Brenda, what's going on here? Is this just a privatisation too far?
I don't know, but at least it gave everybody a chance to have a good laugh at it. It was a bit of light relief, as you said.
Funnily enough, it was just opposite the Bristol United Press, wasn't it? So I wondered if maybe someone was having a bit of an in-joke. But anyway, Martin...
Well, maybe we should just dig it up and sell it and see if on eBay, like Banksy, and see if we can get some money for it.
That's actually not such a bad idea, is it? Keep it there and actually start calling all the buses, spelling them with a P as well. What about this Banksy business, though? Because it does seem, I mean, it's an interesting... I mean, I'm not quite sure how these things work. I wish Banksy would come and spray something on the side of my house and I could sell it for £400,000. It's not exactly the best way to make sure that Bristol's voluntary organisations, in this case it's a youth project, stay open.
Well, no, but on the other hand, I think Banksy is a product of Bristol culture, and the fact that he's decided to donate his work to this community project is commendable, really.
But we're at the stage, Brenda, now where so many of these important projects, I mean, we're going back to the arena, millions of pounds spent on this, but youth clubs are having to close.
Well, the Youth Links project came in under the previous administration and I actually opposed it. So I've got very strong feelings on this. The whole project is up for review next year, I think it is, and we will be looking at it very, very carefully then.
Okay, Brenda Massey, you're the assistant mayor, one of the many, many assistant mayors.
There's only four of us.
And with responsibility for children and young people in education. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. After the news, everything Bristol's mainstream media has been keeping from you.
BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, David Cameron says he'll introduce new laws to combat terror suspects after the threat level was raised across the UK. We're now at severe, the second highest level. The Prime Minister's pledging to seize passports from people who join extremists like Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. But Shadow Home Secretary Yvette Cooper thinks ministers could go further.
There are areas they could reform, including strengthening the prevent programme and also looking again at control orders. It's really important that we stop people becoming radicalised, but also can take action if they return and pose a threat.
There's further concern for a five-year-old boy who was removed from a hospital by his own parents. Doctors say the battery in his feeding system is likely to have run out. Aisha King, who has a brain tumour, was taken from Southampton General yesterday and boarded a ferry to France, where Interpol has issued a global alert. Our reporter, not Robert Nisbet's, in Cherbourg.
This now is truly an international